All right, good morning. Welcome to the May 31st meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. Today, we are going to have an informational hearing. So I'll open an informational hearing on the significance to our economic opportunity in the state of public sector employment. And we've got with us today Mark McMullen from the Oregon State Economist and Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis, who are always really great presenters. So welcome, gentlemen, and please let us know how we should consider this important subject.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McMullen, the Oregon State Economist, and joined, as usual, by my colleague, Josh Lehner. Thanks for having us today. We've just prepared some brief remarks about the role of government in the Oregon economy, particularly the rural economy of Oregon and in the non-metropolitan areas, where government in particular, the direct impacts of government employment and wages and the like are disproportionately large. They play a disproportionate role in rural Oregon's economy, but it's important to note that that's not because government is big in rural Oregon. It's not because rural Oregonians love their teachers or their firefighters more than anyone else does. It's more because the private sector is relatively small in rural Oregon. And that's really the difference, because it's about our metropolitan areas are much larger with big, diverse economies, and they have a lot of other things other than government. Everywhere has teachers. Everywhere has firefighters. But not everywhere has ballet dancers or advertising executives and the like. And so as a result, we see really a disproportionate role for government in our rural counties. Now, overall, in Oregon, the direct role of government employment and wages hasn't really changed much over the last few decades. Here you see the number of employees per 1,000 residents in Oregon. So the concept of government as relative to the size of the population. And when we combine all of them together, federal, state, and local, and state and local, you see we've really seen roughly 70 to 80 government workers per 1,000 people in the state ever since the 1970s. And this was the time when we saw the baby boom population cohort hit the school enrollment. So we saw this big climb in the 60s and the 70s. We also saw a larger state safety net at the federal level, which required workers at all levels of government as well. So federal, you see, well, so what makes up these lines? The federal government in Oregon are some. We have a couple of real big players there, the Postal Service, the Forest Service, the Bonneville Power, and the like, make up federal government. And that's been somewhat declining over time, made up for by a rise in state and local employment. State and local employment is typically almost two-thirds K-12 education and one-third what you'd call agency or office employment, likely. So it's what's the right size of government? That's hard to say. And it's hard, you know, economists argue over that and have for years. What should this be? Not sure what it should be, but at least it's been unchanged over time in Oregon. At least it's stable in terms of the role of government where over time. Going forward, we have a couple of offsetting factors in terms of demographics. In particular, the K-12 population as a share of the overall Oregon population is shrinking. And so we would expect fewer in terms of the K-12 workforce. However, at the same time, we're seeing our elderly populations grow, and that would require more administrators for our safety net programs like Medicare and Social Security. But while we've been stable, you know, looking at the statewide total, we haven't really seen big shifts in the size of and the role of government. We certainly have at the local level, in particular, for a lot of our rural counties. And Josh is going to have some comments on that.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. And this chart really just looks at the last 30 years' annual growth rates in terms of jobs and in terms of wages overall. Not wages per worker, but total wages when you multiply average wage gains times the number of employees added to the economy. And you can see there's been considerably different performance. On the urban side, as a story we probably know quite considerably, the job growth numbers and the wage growth numbers are stronger than what we've seen in rural areas. And the private sector has added, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5% private sector job growth in the last 30 years, whereas government in urban areas is more like 1.5%. So in the urban areas, the government as a share of all private sector jobs and a share of wages is actually on the decline to a certain degree. As Mark just showed you, on a per person basis, it's stable. It's just the private sector growth has been significantly faster than the public sector growth. In the urban or in the rural areas, that's a little bit different. Growth rates overall, again, are slower. We know that. But the private sector and the public sector are increasing at basically the same rate over the last 30 years. And the 30 years is not some magic number. You can basically pick any year from 1980 through today, and the same analysis would apply, where in the rural communities, public sector is adding 1% jobs and the private sector is adding 1% jobs in the typical year. And so overall, you know, again, in most of our rural communities, the public sector, again, is not becoming larger and larger and larger over time, at least when you lump all these these counties into these broad categories. However, it is also, you know, maintaining its relative share and its relative pace. Now, that said, the performance or the differences seen across all of our communities can vary greatly. And this next map kind of shows that. Here we're just talking about wages, not jobs, but total wages as a share of all wages generated in the county. What share represent public employees? Again, federal, state, and local levels. And here, again, overall Oregon 16%, urban areas more like 14%, rural areas closer to 25% of all local wages come from the public sector. And again, some of these counties have considerably higher shares, particularly the southern and eastern parts of the state, where we're talking 25, 30, 40, sometimes 50% of all wages in the county are public sector wages. And as Mark was talking about, that's not necessarily because the public sector is so large, it's because some of these communities have seen such long-term deterioration or lack of private sector growth. And so over time, in our southern communities, Coos in particular, Harney, Malheur, Grant, Wheeler to some degree, there the public sector is increasing as a share over time due to the private sector job losses. In our other rural communities, particularly the northern coast, the Columbia River Gorge, northeastern Oregon, by and large, there that is not the case because they have seen relatively robust private sector growth, particularly when you compare that with rural America more broadly and the like.
That's right. And so it becomes really extreme in some of our communities, particularly out east, where the cities are even further along the spectrum than we see here at the county level, with some of our cities at more than half their employment base covered by the public sector. So to sum up, there are a couple of things that are particularly notable for rural economies and the with government jobs, insofar as government jobs provide two things that are very valuable. One is cushion from recessions and the business cycle shocks, and the other would be access to educated workforce and the ability to draw folks with skills and productive workers to the areas. So the first one of that those two is providing a recessionary buffer. Unfortunately, in a lot of our most distressed rural communities, when we do have a recession, the shock forces a lot of households out of the area, many of which don't come back. And a lot of times these are our prime working age skilled households that are forced out. Well, one thing that's nice about having a lot of exposure to public sector wages and workforce is that it's less sensitive, at least in terms of timing, to the to the overall business cycle, and this allows a little bit of protection during recessions, which tend to be very rough in rural areas. So why is it? You see here, as a share of all wages in rural Oregon, during recessions, the public sector takes a big step up and then comes back down to earth, as it has in recent years, to its normal range of somewhere around 24% of all wages in rural areas. So why is it? Well, I'll just point out a couple of the reasons I've listed on the right. On the demand side, probably should have put the third one first. Part of the reason why the government shields things so well in rural Oregon is that the other industries are so darn volatile. The resource industries and the manufacturing industries in recessions traditionally just get hammered. And so anything that doesn't fall like a rock during a recession in rural Oregon is going to help support the economy in a relative sense. And so that has a lot to do with it. But it also, just in general, the need for our public services goes up during recessions as well. Caseloads for our Medicaid and our income maintenance programs, as well as enrollment at colleges and universities, as folks either try to go get new skills or are pushed out of the workforce, without good job opportunities.
Representative Brock Smith.
If I just can point something out. So in your previous slide, you spoke about the cushion. It's true, in my district, which is Southwest Oregon, there is a somewhat of a cushion. It almost feels like when the recession hit in 2008, I don't know about Representative Reske on the other side, but there was a delay in those effects. And so where it might have hit everywhere in 2008, it didn't really hit us until about 2009 and later. But then it lasted longer. And as you said, a lot of folks exited our area. One of the reasons why it's still 6.4% below mean zero pre-recession unemployment there, in my district. The other point is with regards to government jobs and the differences between Eastern Oregon possibly and our, rural Southwest Oregon is the tourism-driven economy. And so although there might be that cushion because of those government jobs, because we've been driven into a tourism or an attempt to be a tourism-driven economy because of the lack of natural resource economic development, the recession hits even harder because as everyone from the more metropolitan and more urban areas are feeling that recession, right now, they're not traveling to our area anymore. Now, that might not be the case for Lake County or the other eastern counties, but it definitely is the case along the coast, especially the Southwest coast, because the folks from Redding that come up or the folks from Portland that come down, they don't take those 5-day trips. They might only take those 2-day trips, and so they go to their own coast.
Yes, Representative Brocksmith and Chair Leininger, absolutely. And it's always the case that, or traditionally has been, that our rural areas overall will get hit harder during the typical recession. This is a timing issue that we're talking about here, but no, absolutely. And there are three predominant reasons for that. One, again, the exposure to the resource industries is a big one, which are always cyclical boom and bust. The other is having a lot of low income households as a share of the overall population. That hurts because low income households are very much exposed to the labor market. They don't have other forms of income to offset job losses and income losses in workforce. So that's obviously a large one as well. And so when we do see these, and of course the lack of economic diversity in terms of, and like you say, now it's a big tourism industry, but wherever it is this time, it was this particular recession hit two industries that are disproportionately sized in rural Oregon, in particular the housing-related industries. Everywhere has construction jobs and housing-related workers, and it also hit K-12 and local government workforce harder than we've seen in the past. because we're running up against some long-term budget problems there as well. And so all things told, yes, and it takes a real big hit on our rural areas. And in areas like Coos County, where you start to lose population, then this, you know, you do start seeing even longer-term effects. And over the long haul, as you lose population, you're also going to see a smaller government as well as a smaller private sector.
Rep. Brocksmith, do you have a follow-up?
Just a quick. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then your next slide where it spoke about the demand for public services, of course, increases. Which is, I guess what I'm trying to put on the record is, in our rural areas, and my district, and along the coast, there's more extremes on either side of the pendulum, right? Because that is also true because of the lower income families, and what little work there is, or the lack thereof, in these situations, they rely more on the public services. But of course, then those public services are hit as well, and we're unable to provide them in those regions because of those public services that are provided by the counties and or cities are reliant on the natural resource dollars that we're supposed to fund them. And so it's the cyclical extreme scenario that is just not beneficial to our citizens in any way.
That's right. Thank you. And it is very important to the extent that we can smooth out these business cycles. And luckily, policymakers do a lot of it. Here on the right-hand side, where we look at the delayed funding losses, the state and local resources in terms of government resources tend to lag the overall business cycle, so it takes a little while before the impact of all these job losses and income losses get felt in terms of the revenue side of the public budget. At the state level, they have all sorts of tricks. The budget reserves, fund sweeps, last recession there was actually, you know, there were even tax increases enacted as well, some of which were temporary. There's also leaning on capital budgets. You know, the general fund, of course, we have to have a balanced budget every 2 years as a government, but that's only about half of what we do because we have these long-term capital projects as well that we spend on. And so the capital budgets are a little bit more stable across time and less sensitive to current revenue streams, and even the current revenue streams take a while to slow down. At the federal level, we usually get, the last two recessions, we've got a stimulus package, but even without one, we get increased caseloads for a lot of our need-based programs, which would bring in additional federal dollars. And in terms of state-specific resources, our big one, the personal income tax, takes a while to slow down because when we go to pay our taxes next year in April of 2018, it'll be about what we made during 2017 and how the stock market and labor markets went then. And so oftentimes there's a little bit of a delay before we feel the full pain of the recession. When it comes, very violently here in terms of revenue declines, but not necessarily in the first year after we see the private sector turn down. And finally, our property taxes are buffered. Property taxes are buffered everywhere. My old speaking point used to be that up until this last recession, it was the case that during recessions, property taxes across America actually grew faster than during expansions. Post-war, up until this last one, I haven't done the calculation after this last recession, but my guess is that would be no longer true, given that we actually, we had a housing recession and some really sharp declines in a lot of places. But not here, partly because of the controls we put on property taxes over the time, in particular this idea of assessed value growing at 3% per year since the mid-90s as our basis for our property taxes. In most of Oregon, even after the housing crash, we didn't get down to that level where we started to see only in the most extreme areas did we see that really become an issue where we started dropping below the assessed value in terms of real market prices. So that's great. It gives us a recessionary buffer. But nevertheless, the recessions still happen, and they're rough. And looking forward in terms of surviving them, as was mentioned by Representative Brock Smith, a lot of times when we have these painful events, we start to lose population in rural areas, and then we get on this downward trajectory. How do you go upward trajectory? Well, probably the regional economists would tell you the best way is to lure educated, skilled workers to your region, and the public sector does play a role in that for rural Oregon as well.
And here we're looking at average wages by private sector versus the public sector by educational attainment for urban Oregon and rural Oregon. And you can see here, it's really about the mix of jobs. So when it comes to wages in and of themselves and how much an employee gets, there's usually generally three things that drive wages. First one is their skill set. What types of skills do they bring in their productivity to the firm or to the agency that they're working for? That's a really hard thing to measure in terms of data and what's available to us. So one thing you can generally use is educational attainment as a shorthand for that, because they're highly correlated, broadly speaking. Even though we know lots of people that are very successful that never went to college, and we know lots of people that aren't the sharpest tool in the shed that did get a college degree, right? There's certainly cases going both ways. We use that as shorthand because they're highly correlated across society, and it matches up with the data relatively well. The other thing is experience. So how much, it's your skills, it's your experience. How much overall experience do you have within the industry, within the firm? Speaking of within the firm and experience, that's where tenure is, right? So how long have you been with this specific employer? So that combination of how long you've been with your overall employer, how much experience do you have in your overall skill set, that generally explains a lot of the variation within wages. So once you start controlling for those sort of things, right, what impact do, say, public sector jobs have in the economy? It's a little bit different in rural Oregon than it is than in urban Oregon. You can see on the left the gap between, say, those with a bachelor's degree or more in urban areas. The gap between the private sector and the public sector is considerably large, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. Now, if we look at total compensation, not just wages, total compensation, that gap narrows because the public sector benefits are significantly larger than the private sector benefits by and large. And so therefore that gap narrows somewhat. But in rural Oregon, we see the same sort of thing where overall, wages are relatively the same for those with a bachelor's degree or more between the private and public sector. However, when it comes to wages being larger for public workers in rural Oregon relative to private workers in rural Oregon, it's mostly about the mix of occupations and the mix of workers, because there are less lifeguards and there are less retail cashiers and there are less waitresses in the public sector than in the private sector. When you control for that occupational mix and only focus on folks, teachers and firefighters and, finance directors for your local governments and things like that, that's really where the wage issue and the wage mix comes in to explain the differences we're seeing across the board, because the public sector work is tilted considerably more towards people with higher educational attainment and less so to ones with lower educational attainment. And so to the extent Mark was saying about, recessionary buffers and then what can you do about the future, the high-wage jobs in the private sector, so your consultants and your doctors and your attorneys and your business and finance occupations more broadly, those are the high-wage jobs that are growing significantly faster than most other jobs in the economy. Job polarization, our office has talked about a lot before, is where we get a lot of high-wage job growth and a lot of low-wage job growth. Well, that high-wage job growth is becoming increasingly concentrated in our metropolitan areas and our urban areas, right? High-rises, office-type work, that's increasingly concentrated in downtown Portland and Eugene and what have you, and it's becoming less concentrated in our rural areas. And so to the extent that the public sector is able to offer some higher wage occupations, higher wage jobs to people of the same skill sets to attract them and retain them in some of our rural communities, that does help offset some of these job polarization trends that we're seeing across the economy in recent decades.
I would love to ask a question. There was a Wall Street Journal article that came out a couple of days ago that was titled Rural America is the New Inner City. And I don't have a current subscription, so I haven't been able to read the whole article, but are you familiar with that? I think it was tracking on parameters like education, divorce rate, opioid addiction, maybe chronic disease, decreasing lifespan, that across all those parameters, the prospects for rural America have decreased. You know, what do you make of that set of data, and how do you translate its ramifications onto our economy and things that we in the legislature can do?
Chair Leininger, I'm familiar with the piece. A lot of what's created, and it is true that we're seeing in terms of measures of need, poverty and the like, and like you say, crime rates and such, we're really seeing an erosion in much of rural America. And a lot of that comes from migration trends. What happens in a lot of rural America is when the jobs dry up, what happens? Well, people leave, particularly young working age households leave the area. And so what remains, are a lot of times more distressed communities. And statistically, we're really seeing that where they are in many cases reaching the level of inner city communities. In Oregon, that's a little bit buffered, not so bad in all of our communities. Some are very much feeling this same dynamic. But that said, the one advantage we have relative to most of rural America is that our population trends in rural Oregon, and in terms of stable population or even somewhat growing in most all of our counties, it might not be young working age households. Oftentimes it's retirees in some of our southern rural areas, but nevertheless, people are still moving there. And as a result, some of these extreme numbers in terms of welfare and poverty and the like aren't quite as pronounced here. And the next thing to note is that as bad as things are in rural America, there's in a lot of places, hopefully it's bottomed out. In terms of economic performance, these things, poverty rates and caseloads for need-based programs and the like, and disability and the like, these things are like the last things to turn around as the economy improves. And we're finally here in Oregon, where we've been ahead of the curve in terms of job growth and income growth, we're finally starting to see that, poverty rates dropping in some of our rural areas and the like. And with any luck, the broader U.S. will start to see some improvement as well going forward. Still elevated relative to need is still elevated relative to where we were before the recession in most of our rural communities, but things are finally improving, and for the most part, we're on a more solid footing than our neighbors in other states.
Thank you. I think Representative Marsh has a question.
Yeah, this is such interesting material, though. I can hold off on my questions if you have more presentation.
No, those are all the prepared remarks we had, so this is perfect.
Okay, then a comment and a couple questions. One is, I think this issue of migration actually is one that we're going to have to, it's a generational issue, has to do with issues far beyond job availability to trends for this generation in terms of desiring urban areas. I think that's pretty well documented across the country, I think, as cities in our urban areas continue to grow with young people. So that certainly we see that in southern Oregon as our young people take that that Interstate 5 trek north. So there are certainly long-term implications there. I think that the material that shows direct government employment really, though, understates the impact of government investments in our communities. If you look at, for example, the impact of health care, and I've seen some data recently which shows what our increased expenditures on Medicaid has done in terms of employment in our rural areas. So there, it would suggest to me as well that this is one part of the picture, but certainly not the whole picture in terms of impact on local economies of government investments. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely, Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh. We stayed away from that because it's a little tricky with the federal role in a lot of this. You know, to what extent this is federal versus state money, but it's a huge deal, and arguably much bigger deal than the direct impact. For example, Medicaid payment per capita now in Oregon since the expansion of the Medicaid population is now to about $1,500 per capita in terms of federal grants we get, which is a lot for a rural area, and that is up about 40% from where it was before the expansion. Where before the expansion, Oregon was somewhere in the middle of the pack, 25th across states in terms of Medicaid dollars per capita. Afterwards, we were successful at enrolling a lot of our eligibles, so now we're up to the top five or six across states, and we had a big jump in that. But that Medicaid is just one big notable example. But yes, the federal grants and the government benefits, in addition to the direct employment, are clearly there as well. It's just a little bit harder to flesh out, one, because of the federal role, two, because these benefits tend to be larger in more distressed communities. Mm-hmm. And so on net, you know, it certainly helps, but on net, those are still distressed communities.
And one final
question. Please, go ahead.
Is what we're really seeing here, when you look at the bottom line, also represent a shift of resources from our urban areas to our rural areas? I mean, things like school teachers can be paid for only partially from their home communities. The rest of the ticket is picked up by taxpayers in our urban areas where you have those high private wages. Is that an accurate statement?
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh. Yeah, to a certain extent, it is accurate insofar as the public sector funding, both in terms of benefit payments and direct employment, does tend to follow population trends. So as population shifts to the Willamette Valley and our large metropolitan areas, so too do public dollars to a certain extent. That said, and not nearly the kind of shift we're seeing in the private sector in terms of the private sector economy becoming much more urban. That's a much more rapid phenomenon than in terms of the public sector.
We have a question from Representative Gomberg, and then Representative Reschke and Representative Lewis, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding your last slide, gentlemen, I certainly hope that your office doesn't also have caricatures of these committee members.
Not that we share.
All right. A couple of questions. All public record, Representative. It's all public record.
Okay.
A couple of quick questions, and I'll be perfectly satisfied with short answers. First of all, I'm going to presume that your county data is based on where an employee resides rather than where they work. For example, if someone works at the Hatfield Center in Newport but lives in Corvallis, their wages would count toward Benton County rather than Lincoln County. Is that correct?
No. For the most part, this is taken from the payroll survey rather than the household survey.
So, Representative Gomberg, it's generally tied to the location of the business. So it's located where the employer is filing taxes from. Now, to the extent that it's somebody that has multiple branches in different counties, they do their best to separate out that data, number of jobs, amount of wages, to the best that they can. It's not perfect because that's an extremely hard thing to do. So your example, ideally, they should be counted as Newport wages because that is where the job is located. They don't actually know necessarily where the person is commuting in from.
All right, thank you. Madam Chair, very quickly. Similarly, if a company or if an agency is sending employees to a different county, would the employee's wages be counted where the employee is based or where the work is being done?
Somewhat similar there, Representative Gomberg, Chair Leininger, it probably will be counted where the business is located. So to the extent you send a construction crew over the mountains to do some framing in Bend or what have you from a Valley company, they're probably going to get counted as Valley wages and Valley employment, even though the work's being done on the other side of the mountains, just because of the nature of the business. That would be generally how that's classified.
And finally, Madam Chair, if we could switch back to slide 4, I'm wondering which of these colored counties, at what point do we start to see a net export of public dollars or net import of public dollars? By that I mean, at what color do we begin to see that a county is getting more dollars coming in than they're sending out?
That's a tricky one, Representative Gomberg. In general, our effective tax rates, you know, at the state and local level change based on income. So it's tricky because folks in the metropolitan areas are going to pay higher effective tax rates. But here in Oregon, we're looking at a 5% Oregon share and maybe a 20% federal share, roughly, so about 25% of a tax burden for an average county. That's, you know, just off the top of my head. So somewhere around that 25% burden would be the point when, you know, the dollars coming in. This is, again, abstracting away. There's a benefit dollars here that are probably distributed differently, but somewhere around the middle there, I would say, is the point where you break even, which in a balanced budget world would make sense. But, of course, in the federal government doesn't necessarily run a balanced budget. But somewhere around... I would say in that 20 to 25% range is the point at which the tax revenue paid into the system is less than the benefits coming out of it in some sense.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reschke and then Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. McMullen and Mr. Lerner, for coming today. Can you go back to slide 3? And so I'm curious about the growth rates here. Just so I understand the chart, we're looking at urban 2.2 and 1.5 for private and public, respectively. And so is that year-over-year growth, or is that growth of the pie in the sense that if I do math and I have a 1.5% growth rate over 30 years, I'm going to have 45% of the pie? That doesn't seem right. So it seems like to me it's a year-over-year growth of 1.5%. So if I had 10 public employees, I would have 11.5 the next year. Is that how that's read?
Yes, Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke. Yes, this is the average annual growth rate. So
okay.
On average, every year, if you grew, in this case, urban would be 2% in the average year over that 20-year period.
And yes. then a follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So something I'll ask you to do in the future, and I've asked other presenters and other committees to do this, is to add the population growth rate then as well, so we have something to compare against. So I went back and did a real quick Google search, and it was about, in 1986, Oregon's population was about 2.6 million, and in 2016 it was about 4 million. So it's about a 35% growth, or 3.5%. It's a 35% growth. So I don't know what that is over a year, but it would just help us understand that better, because if you're growing at 1.5% but your population is growing at 2%, that helps me understand what's going on during that time period. You know, the population is declining but the population of the public sector is growing, then I see we have a problem. So that's one thing I'd ask, and then just one more follow-up is you mentioned during, is that okay?
Please, yes.
All right, thanks. You mentioned that government jobs tend to be a buffer during recessions. Did I capture that? Okay, so do you see any time where government should contract when an economy is contracting, or is government this ever-present, it's got to be here, and then it's got to grow a little, and it stays, and it's got to grow a little? Where do we end in that scenario? Is there, in your view as an economist, when is it appropriate for government to contract?
Yeah, Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke, it's very hard to say. For most of our models, we think of most of our government services are a function of the size of our population. And so in general, for the typical ones, you would like to see, you know, it growing along with population. Now, obviously, there are counterexamples to that, right? The Forest Service has more to do with forest fire risk and that than it does the population. Or maybe the number of building inspectors is probably should be tied closely to economic activity and things like that. So broadly, that can't be said. But for the most part, we usually think of the demand for public services based on the caseloads. You know, what are school age population of children? How about elderly folks? You know, and you know how many of those are there? That would be your your need for Social Security Administration and Medicare Administration and the like. And so for the most part, I like to think of it as a function of the population. But economists are very split in terms of what the right size of government is.
Yeah, and I wasn't asking for that because I know that's a difficult question. But I just wanted to know what you're comparing, what you thought was the best model, and you're saying don't measure it against the economy, measure it against your population growth. Is that correct?
I think so.
In general.
And to your first comment about what's going on with the population relative to employment growth, well, over the last 15 to 20 years, that's been declining in terms of the employment to population ratio. There's cyclical wiggles in it, but we've seen a pretty distinct decline in that, and the reasons for that are pretty straightforward insofar as the baby boom population cohort is entering their retirement years, and so the number of workers we have per person in the economy is going down and has been for about 15 to 20 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the same slide, the wage side of this, is that total compensation package or is that just salary?
Chair Leininger, Representative Lewis, that is just salary. And because at the granular level of the different counties, it's really hard to get the compensation packages, and we didn't try and make an assumption about how that would be distributed evenly. So we're just talking about wages here. And as I tried to highlight on the last slide, is that if we included compensation, that would make those public sector bars larger because the compensation packages are more generous for public employees.
Thank you. Yes.
And to that point, do you maintain any data on? I mean, this information is all really good, but do you maintain any data on the employer costs comparison between, for example, private sector employer cost for retirement, for insurance, for all of those things versus public sector?
Chair Leininger, Representative Lewis, our office does not. There's a number of national surveys from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that try to get that on a fairly regular basis. But given the diversity of options, both in the private sector and the public sector, when you look across states, it's really hard to get a uniform measure of that across jurisdictions and across time. So they do it at the federal level in terms of U.S. data. They try to, and I think they give some regional breakouts of the West. So basically the Great Plains through us over here on the coast, you know, they might have a Western number for that, where you could do private versus public. Generally conforming data that's consistent across time is a challenging thing to do. And so we usually rely on, occasionally a state or a consultant firm or whatever will do a massive study every couple of years. And that kind of is the general numbers that people use until the next one of those comes out a few years later.
That's right.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Madam Chair. So there isn't anybody that you know of that maintains that data that's specific to Oregon?
Not to my knowledge.
Representative Lewis, off the top of my head, the answer is no. I'm sure some of the folks in the budget office and with PERS and whatnot would be able to get some Oregon State employee information. And then maybe the School Board Association would be able to help with some of the K-12 districts and whatnot. But by and large, again, a nice database where you can pull it all in nicely is beyond our grasp at this point in time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you for this presentation. As we are wrapping up the work of our committee, I want to note that we spent a lot of energy this session trying to support some sectors that involve rural agriculture and light manufacturing / value-added processing in the beer, wine, spirits, cider arena. We had both bills that we originated in this chamber and then some bills that came over from the other chamber. In addition, the work that we have done in the legislature related to hemp production, and I know the Agriculture Committee has done some work on that. The Marijuana Committee passed a bill out yesterday night unanimously. and processing on that front, and the cannabis sector and processing and licensure. And Representative Gomberg has a good amendment that I think is going to go into a bill to allow vertical integration of some processing that will benefit rural communities and smaller producers. I think all of those things are some of the aspects in which we're trying to support additional economic opportunity in our rural areas, across laminated timber work that we endorsed as a committee that hopefully will get some investment at the ways and means level, broadband access that we've tried to support, tourism steps that we've tried to support. All of those things have a role, but I think a real issue for our state, and I think almost all of us have some connection to rural Oregon as kids or through our families or through where we currently live. You know, I think one of our biggest issues as a state is what to do about the fact that our rural communities are struggling in a whole bunch of ways, as manifest by a whole bunch of data, including in this Wall Street Journal article that's kind of generalized about the country overall. So it's so important work for us to keep doing. I want to renew the invitation to members of the committee, if you're interested in setting up an information session or asking Mr. Crawford to help set up an information session between now and, you know, 6 weeks from now, the end of the session. We would love that. We've got something coming, hopefully, related to the Klamath base, and Representative Reschke. Anyone else is welcome to do that. And otherwise, thanks for your good work, and thank you to our fine panel for this interesting presentation. Any closing comments? Okay. Yes, please.
Well, no, I just I appreciate the work of this committee and all the members on it. Economic development's always been a passion of mine. I was a chamber director and president for almost a decade, and then as a county commissioner, we oversee, you know, economic development departments and drive their work. And I also want to thank you, Madam Chair, for all of your great work and leadership in the committee and bringing bills to the committee that we can chew on and push out. I want to remind you and everyone that we had unanimous votes on almost all bills except for one, which, as Representative Marsh knows, was one that we worked on and she worked on
quite a bit,
that's right. Which was the interior folks. And if I still said, and it'll still be on the record, that if there is another work group, Representative Poles, Representative Reschke have always already volunteered with their no votes to be on that work.
All right. Let the record reflect. All right.
Gavel, will you?
Hey, thanks, everybody, and thank you to our presenters. Meeting is adjourned.